This recording is brought to you by the Charlottesville Podcasting Network. Visit us at sevillepodcast.com. Kelly Corrigan, author of The Middle Place, spoke to an audience at the New Dominion Bookshop on September 15, 2009. She was joined by her father, George, and his brother, Gene.
So, hi. Thanks for coming. I love bookstore readings. I love, this is an awesome bookstore.
Isn't it great?
Amazing. So, you know, with this small a group, we could you could just fire away. I could ask you questions. You could tell me what you want me to read, you know, take requests, whatever you want. So, you know, as I always say, this book really came about because I had this assumption that life was totally linear. You had childhood, and then something turned you into an adult. Like you had a child, or you moved to California, you got a tattoo, you started voting Democrat in a family full of Republicans, whatever it was that made you feel independent and quote unquote all grown up. And that's really where I was, you know. I was 36 years old, I lived in California, where I still live now. And I had these two little kids, and I was paying a mortgage and doing my tax returns all by myself, and even paying my own visa bills, which wasn't always the case. And I got this phone call that I had a runaway case of breast cancer and that I'd be in chemotherapy in a week. And I took a deep breath, and then for some reason, my husband and I went and got a Corona and sat on the deck and drank beer, and we were kind of speechless for a while. But it was this, you know, strangely sunny day, like too sunny for the events that were unfolding kind of day. And then I was like, all right, we're gonna have to call home. And we did, and I knew when I was dialing the phone that they would come. I mean, I knew what I was doing to them because I had become a parent myself, and so it was clear that I was taking, for instance, my mother to the worst moment of her life. And I was recently talking to a woman about that, actually, whose brother died in a car accident, and for some reason, the police could not find her parents, but they found her. And then she had to call her parents. And she said it took her 90 minutes to dial the phone. She must have picked up the phone like, you know, 40 times before she was like, I just can't do this. I can't say these words, like this is their moment. So anyway, over the course of that fall, my parents took really good care of me. And it was a really kind of wonderful time, actually. My cancer responded really well to chemotherapy, which is where I started with the whole thing, instead rather than surgery. And about a month into it, the tumor was smaller and softer, and we had reason to be optimistic that it was going to be fine. And once we turned that corner, I did feel like I kind of leaned back into the whole thing and enjoyed it for what it was, which was a time when tons of things didn't get done. Tons of things that probably aren't even worth doing, which I'm back to doing now. And, you know, I had no to-do lists, and everything in my house was just fine. There was nothing to be painted or moved or replaced. And my weight was just fine. There was no reason to go on a diet or start exercising. And, you know, the people I had around me were just right. And then I was almost finished. I'd done 7 rounds, and we were getting closer to Christmas, and my whole family was going to come for Christmas, and it was going to be this great California vacation for everybody. And then my mom called and said, oh, my hepatitis, but apparently your father had some blood in his urine, and he went to see a doctor, and he's got cancer. And I thought, oh, this is adulthood. This is the first adult moment of my life. These kind of trivial reasons. And then realized I wasn't grown up at all, I did come to believe that there's a difference between people who have lost someone and people who haven't. I think that there's like a, I just think it must be different, you know, once you realize the finality, once you internalize the fact of mortality. And I just hadn't yet. And then when my dad got sick and it was such a complicated case, and although his optimism never waned, as it never will, I'm sure, his doctor was really, you know, not optimistic. And it was just the first time that it really, really sunk in. Like, you just won't be able to talk to him. Like, whatever happens to you, there'll be a day where you just cannot find him. in the world. And I couldn't get over that idea that I just, and to this day, I haven't had to do it really. And it's so I do think it is the dividing line. The book has a lot of comic relief, thank God, because it's needed. Every other chapter is a flashback to childhood. And those chapters were so fun to write and so easy to write. Now I'm trying to write a second book now and it's so not easy. But those chapters were like the stories that I had been telling my whole life. Hi.
Sorry.
That's all right. Those were the stories that I had just been telling my whole life, you know? And so they were really easy to just, you know, it was almost like taking dictation or something compared to what I'm in the middle of writing a second book now, which is why I had to run off and email that thing because it was due on June 29th and then it was due on August 17th and then it was due on Friday and then it got due on Monday and then I was like, I swear to God, I will not go to bed on Tuesday night before I send it to you. And I'm actually going to be face-to-face with them in New York tomorrow, so I really needed to send it, so sorry about that. But anyway, this book is much harder to write because these are not the stories that I've told my whole life, the ones that I'm trying to tell now. And, you know, we're from a storytelling people. And so that was really a joy to try to get that stuff down on paper. But also, it turned out that, and I believe this for anyone who writes here in the room, that you should just, whatever your gut is that you're starting to write about, just go ahead and write about it because there's a reason why your gut is holding it. And it may take you like 5 revisions to figure out what the nut of the story is, but there's something subconscious in you that's saying, this was important. You know, there was something in this moment that stuck with me. And memories are so shoddy and few that if you've held on to something since you were 10, it was big. You might not realize why, but it was big. So anyway, when I was looking at the stories later, I was thinking, that it became so obvious to me over time why those were the stories that should be told and how they sort of dovetailed into this larger question of, you know, what it is to be someone's child when you're a child and what it is to be their child when you're an adult. So if you want, I'll read something and then we could talk amongst ourselves and pass the baby around. I have no idea what to read. Is there anything anyone would like me to read? No? I'm just going to go for it. All right.
I think one of the funniest passages that I'll never forget is when you were telling about your Uncle Gene telling the story about your dad's first job.
Oh, I've never read that. That's perfect. That is so perfect.
It's so funny.
Oh, that's great. It was so funny, and we have it on videotape, so that one I could really, like, almost transcribe. Oh, God, it was so funny. There's something so funny about seeing old men, sorry, laugh so hard like that. It's so boyish. It's such a boyish thing to be doubled over laughing and, like, holding your crotch like you're going to pee. And that's what was happening, is they were just stomping their feet and laughing at them, and that was making us laugh so hard. And so, yeah, no, this is great. If I can find it, I will do it. Okay. So this comes, I found a way to tell this story that dovetailed thematically, because I really just wanted to tell this story. But the link was that I used to have panic attacks. So I would have those terrible bouts with anxiety. And I didn't have them my whole life. I just had them. They just hit me one time in New York. And then I went straight home to my mother, who was just unbelievable in a crisis. And she just doubled down and took care of me the way only she can. And then I didn't want to fly after that. And I didn't want to go back to New York because I was afraid that somehow there was some trigger there that I wasn't aware of that it was going to happen again. And if anyone has ever had it, it's such an awful feeling. And but then my dad was retiring from Good Housekeeping, and slowly it became clear, and work in general. Now he's just got my mom, who's his sugar mama, who pays all the bills. So anyway, it became clear over time that like everyone was going to my dad's retirement, but me. And you know, I would be the first person to go to his retirement, but there were these circumstances. So anyway, I do want to read a little bit about the panic attack because it honors the part of my mother that I love the most. So I'll just say that, just assume that I have had the panic attack. I took the Amtrak home to Wooded Lane and sat at the kitchen table where I had played quarters with my brothers, where I was grounded for drinking at the sophomore dance, where I read the love letter to my mom. She was at the sink right where she always stood, wearing her new black work pants, shelling salted peanuts and looking out the window into the backyard. I was afraid to tell her how I had the chills and then the sweats, how tight my head was and how shallow my breathing got. I was so sure I needed testing and an overnight stay and probably some kind of medication. Mom, something happened today. It was a risk taking this to my mom. She had not soothed me when I was rejected by the admissions directors at the University of Virginia. Because I wasn't good enough. Or because Gene just had to go get the job at Notre Dame. If he had stayed for one more year. Or the hiring director at Camp Taqua, or a popular Washington Lee lacrosse player named Jeff Mason. In each case, she had said something like, "That's why you shouldn't get your hopes up." But this was different. This had physical symptoms. Throughout our childhood, she lived to consult her medical encyclopedia and diagnose our bunions, cysts, scabies, and bronchitis. Illness was her specialty. "Yeah," she said, cracking open a peanut. "Mom, there's something wrong with me, and I don't know what it is or how to make it go away, but there's something really wrong with my head or my thoughts, or I don't know, but it's unbearable." She was looking at me with a peanut shell in her palm, seeming almost offended, like, "You stop that talk right now. There is absolutely nothing wrong with my daughter. My daughter's head is just fine." I mean, I felt insane today. I felt like I was going to run into the street screaming. I felt totally out of control, like I was having a total fucking breakdown. And if it happens again, I mean, it just cannot happen again, Mom. I can't take it. It was unbearable. I mean, something is wrong, Mom, with my head, and I can't stand it. And if it happens again, you're going to have to take me to the hospital because they're going to have to put me under because it's just too much. I'd rather lock myself upstairs in my bedroom. Now she looked scared. She dropped her peanut shells in the sink. "Well, we'll go see someone. We'll call your father's insurance company and we'll get some names of local people to see in the morning. George," she called upstairs, "George." So she cleared her throat and assumed a tone of total competence. With my dad's insurance card on the table in front of her, she talked to a hotline operator about psychiatrists, a type of medical professional she was country to meet with executives in New York. She was jotting down notes and saying things like, "And I was so relieved, I nearly passed out right there at the table." I spent the next 2 weeks by my mom's side. She drove me to see two different anxiety specialists. While I sat on sofas describing my symptoms to professionals, my mom waited outside in the car for me, sometimes for an hour. When I said I was afraid to fly, she called the airlines and postponed my trip back to California. When I said I was anxious about my visa bill, she wrote a check for $3,612 without fanfare or discussion of reimbursement. When I said I was ready to go back to San Francisco, she found three panic therapists near my office. At the airport, she bought me a book, two magazines, and a pack of gum. And then, as if she had not already made her devotion manifest, when we hugged goodbye, she bawled. "If you need me, you call me. I can be in your apartment in 6 hours, okay?" Yep, I hugged her. We smiled and nodded to each other and hugged again. "Thanks, Mom." Then, wiping our eyes, we came back to ourselves. I didn't go back east for a while after that. The Kaplan deal never materialized, and although I was out of debt, I had very little coming in. Plus, even though I was making progress in therapy, I was still uneasy about flying and a little superstitious about New York in particular, it being the location of my first panic attack. But my dad was retiring after almost 50 years of selling ad space, and what had started as a nice office party had grown into a command performance. GT called to tell me the event had been moved from a large boardroom to the formal dining room they reserved for first ladies and princesses. All the Corrigans were going, and GT said if I could get there, we could make it a surprise, and wouldn't that be great? I had been to Greeny's New York office many times, I told myself. It was a safe place. I ran through our usual routine in my mind. I'd sleep over at Wooded Lane. Around 5:45, the alarm would go off, and Greeny would appear in my doorway in his blue pinstripe pajamas. "Hello, world," he'd say with a smile. "I'm up," I'd say, lifting myself up on one elbow. "Don't forget to turn off the electric blanket." "Yep." My dad cut things close. No time for breakfast, only coffee. I'd ride to the train station with wet hair, putting on mascara at stoplights. "Lovey, is that Great Lash?" my dad would ask, wanting to know if his customers at Maybelline were cutting it with my generation. "Dad, Great Lash is for 8th graders. This is L'Oreal." "The Frenchies, huh? They're good guys, the L'Oreal gang." As soon as we'd pull into the North Philly Amtrak station, a rundown place where my dad's car had been repeatedly vandalized, he'd say, "Run over there and tell him to hold the train for the green man." Because who wouldn't hold a train for the green man? Once on the train, there'd be at least 5 people to say hello to. "Ruth, this is my daughter, Kelly," my dad would say. Ruth must have been a very serious woman not to have elicited a nickname from my dad, not even Ruthie. "Good morning, Kelly. I've certainly heard a lot about you." Then we'd move down the aisle and talk to Ted, Teddo, and Jimmy, Jimbo, and a guy my dad just called Elvis, for reasons that were never made clear to me. Each of them would reinforce Ruth's claim that I was the subject of much conversation. "Oh, well, you're just as beautiful as your dad said you were." "Ah, the California girl, Kelly the world traveler. I know all about your adventures." At the office, it'd be more of the same, starting with Mick, Irish, the building security guy, who loved telling me about how my dad once forgot an umbrella, so he borrowed Mick's shabby raincoat for a big sales call. Then we'd go straight to the second floor, to the publisher's office, where my dad would chat up Lorraine, the secretary with the best workspace in the building. Lorraine, this is my daughter Kelly Corrigan," my dad would say. "Lorraine here is basically running the place. Word on the street is the big guy calls her once a day from the golf course in Bermuda. Right, Lorraine?" We all laugh more at his delivery than his content. Then Alan Waxenberg, who just tracked me down. Did he track you down?
Yes.
This is so fun. It's because, you know, I put in all the real names when I could, and then all these people are now finding us again. It's so fun. So Waxy, as he was known, found us. Would call us into his stately office. "George Corrigan, bring that girl in here. I want to see if she knows where you were last week." "Oh, come on, Wax or Wacko." A skinny guy with a squonky voice whose real name I can never remember. He was 15 years younger and Jewish, and all the jokes between them were around those points. "Your father's like my exchange beast," my dad would say, slightly off on the key participants in the conflict there. "Well, your father's so old, he probably won't be able to represent his delegation much longer. But you know, when you grow up with John Abbott and Henry Adams, this is his best stuff, lovey. He just beats it like a drum. It's all he's got," my dad would say. Clinging to my familiarity with his office and his coworkers, I booked a flight. I knew they'd all be there, Waxy, Dr. Wacko, Lorraine, Irish. And besides, I was sure once I saw my dad, I'd be home free. I listened to Liz Phair and Annie DeFranco all the way across the country, internalizing their bold, nervy lyrics. About halfway through the flight, I fell asleep. When I came to, I congratulated myself, drowsiness being the exact opposite of panic. Sleeping on a flight to New York was a victory. I got in early, so I walked around Central Park, practicing my toast until it got too cold, and then I sat in someone's dark cubicle waiting for GT's signal. Coming down the hall in a silk Banana Republic scarf that I thought made me look professional, I could hear the booming voices of my aunts and uncles and cousins, and I was glowing with tribal pride. I was a Corrigan. When I turned the corner, Greeny said my name so loudly that the whole room started laughing and clapping and tearing up while Greeny and I hugged and rocked back and forth and laughed into each other, and my dad called out my name again and again, "Lovey, Lovey." Until I became a mother, it was the most irreplaceable I ever felt. I had made the night. But then I watched him greet Rocky Shepherd and Chris Birch and Betty Moran, and I realized that making people feel irreplaceable was his gift. After an hour or so, the toast began. Booker rewrote the words to a poem my dad often recited after a couple beers, "The Cremation of Sam McGee." Do you know it? Just 1,000 verses. 1,000 verses. GT talked about what it takes to be a great salesman in America, personal relationships, and how nothing came more naturally to Big George than relationships. I went last and announced that Greeny had been moonlighting all these years at a small organization he started in Villanova, namely our family, and that while we appreciated his fine efforts over the years and had cut back his hours considerably, retirement was not an option. Then Uncle Gene took the floor and brought the room to tears with an old story about Greeny's first job. The night ended with several rousing verses of our family fight song. C-O-R-R-I. Greeny, you gonna help me here? G-A-N spells Corrigan. Proud of all the Irish blood that's in me. Never a man to say a word again me. C-O-R-R-I. G-A-N, you'll see. It's a name that shame never has been connected with. Corrigan, that's me. Greeny capped off the song with his signature move, which he's probably dying to do right now, the leaping leprechaun heel click, which thrilled the crowd, even as some of us imagined a broken hip. The next morning, I had to be up and out early. I stepped in to say a quick goodbye to my parents, and there in Greeny's Marion Cricket Club duffel on the floor in the hotel room. Oh, I'm gonna skip this, it's too embarrassing for him. I don't know when it happened or how he hit it or what it meant, but other than he was getting old and things were starting to break down and it wasn't going to be long before his mortality started showing. But rather than play out that line of thinking, I chose instead to relive the end of the night, how the whole room, his sales buddies, Dr. Wacko, Waxy, the ladies who at work who saved cookies for Greeny after testing new recipes, sang along with Peggy, Mary, Greeny, and his brothers. To me, this was what family was. Carousing, demonstrative, and attached at 1,000 points. So that was cool. That was like a reenactment, kind of. You know? We're like moving from a reading to a reenactment. So I'm happy to take questions if you have any. Yeah?
When is your next book coming out?
It's coming out in March of next year, or so, supposedly.
What's it about?
I don't know.
You don't know?
No, I'm struggling with it a little bit. But I am going to pass around my computer so that you can give me your email. I just have this list of emails here. And I'll email you if and when I ever write a second book, which, you know. I mean, I did just send something in. So just put your email in and then... And then hit return, and the next person can do it. If you want, if you don't want to know about when the next book is, hey, that's fine. Whatever. I don't know why you're here, but whatever. It's about. I mean, it's definitely a little bit about my cousin Kathy, who's Jean's daughter and Lena's daughter. Her son died in a car accident, as maybe you know, and. So that had a really huge impact on me. I was a brand new mother at the time. And, you know, it's just, it was a crossing over for me from this abstract idea that sometimes bad things happen to it actually happening. And I think it's really changed me as a mother. You know, and it happened before I had cancer and before my daughter had meningitis. And, you know, before, I mean, now you get older, it's like unbelievable how much stuff is happening around you all the time and how much more in touch you are with the risk involved with just living day to day and loving people as much as you love them. And, but for me, that was my kids and just what it's like to be their mother. And so, I don't know, an anthology about the Green Man. He's just that crazy. And I must say that it's such a surprise to me that the book did well and was popular because men or how they brought strange men home and slept with them, you know, while you were watching cartoons or it's beautiful. I don't know why anyone would want to read about us. And I was like, I don't either, but apparently they're going to sell it. And so it's amazing that people liked it.
So yeah. What are your thoughts?
It's so cool. It's so cool. I mean, it's this whole thing has been so incredibly positive. I love my agent. I love the book. which I don't really feel like I can say yet about the second book, so now I understand how rare that is to feel so good about something. It's easier to feel good about your first time than your second time, though. You know, you're harder on yourself, and you don't feel like a novice anymore, and you don't give yourself all that room to think, like, I've never done this before. Why should I expect so much of myself? It's been such a fun thing for my family, like tonight being a perfect example. I mean, this is just a great night in my life. And today was a blast. And so it's just been full of positive. It's been 100% positive. Except for one weenie who mouthed off to my dad about how he thought I shouldn't have written this book. But other than that, that was the only little speck on this whole thing. So.
Have you ever had that kind of response before?
No, never. The only response I was really worried about going into it was if people would pick up on the arc with my mom. So I think as a mother, to have the first sentence of a book be the thing you need to know about me is I'm George Corrigan's daughter, you know, after you have busted your ass every day for your kids and your husband comes blowing through the door for an hour a day and gives them popsicles after dinner, you know, would be like, oh my God, how could you say that? But she loved it. So when she first read it, her reaction was, Kelly, it's beautiful. And which I really respected because she's a great reader. She reads constantly. But then I got afraid again because I thought, you know, what might happen is that some of her girlfriends might read it. And if one person says some slightly jokey but sarcastic thing that gets under her skin about like, well, I certainly hope my daughter doesn't write a memoir, you know, or one little thing like that could sort of give her this sense that she's being laughed at, or, you know, that would be, you know, that would make me want to throw the whole thing away and have never done it in the first place. You know, I would, because she's such a good mom and she's so devoted and she should never be maligned. But of course, I was a teenage girl. And she was the mother of a teenage girl, and we did what those people do. you know? Mm-hmm. So anyway, but everybody seems to have gotten it. And a lot of times I hear from readers, your mother's the unsung hero of that book, or your mother's the quiet hero of that book. And I think you're a good reader. Because the truth is, like, while my dad and I, it's like a love affair, like if we weren't related this way and we just met each other, we would just be the best of friends, you know. We just are suited to each other. My mom and I, if we met each other, she would probably think I talk too much and too loud, and I would probably think she has a little bit of a sour look on her face. Now I can't tell if she's having a good time tonight. And we would have gone our separate ways. But I feel really lucky to know my mom and to be her kid, and I'm certainly turning into her. I mean, socially I'm much different, but you know, at home with my daughters, I totally, you know, he said yes, she said no, I say no. So,
yeah. I can remember when you were first getting cut in and fitting for your book, and Kathy.
Well, I was here. I was here. My dad was with me. You know, my agent, who at the time I couldn't even say the words my agent without feeling. So, but anyway, she said, you know, I have your first offer. And then the next day she said, we have two more offers. And I mean, I just hang up the phone and come in to Kathy and say, like, What? I didn't even say it. Manchester wants to buy. Be thinner. I wanted to stop smoking, and I wanted to write books. And you know, I did one. Now I don't smoke anymore either. But that's
when you were 12.
Yeah, exactly. Yeah, you go through the college journals. It's like I gotta stop smoking. I gotta lose weight, and I want to be a writer, which is such a funny idea, you know. Because, like, anyone can be a writer, you just write.
Were you an English major?
I was, and I have a master's in English literature, and that's why I'm so qualified. Yeah.
Fun question. I loved your book, and also your piece that
happens either. Wherever in the O magazine.
Oh, thanks.
And it's kind of where my question's going. You write about in those moments after getting the phone call with the diagnosis, you and your husband, the quote you gave it to Google,
yeah,
as opposed to your parents, who, again, the quote you gave it to God.
Yeah.
And I would love just to hear you speak more about that, like in this day of like Facebook, texting, or overcommitted, and just as also a parent with young kids, like, anything you have to say about spirituality and like parenting and like.
Well, that's in this new book a little bit. I long for it, mm-hmm. And I have very mixed feelings. Like, I'm always in a bad mood on Sunday mornings. Like, I always feel kind of shitty. Like, what are we doing? Like, we need to be doing something. These kids need to be like, we all need it. We all need to be thinking bigger thoughts once in a while. And, you know, I didn't, so, you know, of course, like every person, I hated going to church when I was a kid. I just wanted to sleep, and I wanted to wear sneakers, and, you know, I wanted to sit when you were supposed to stand, and I wanted to lean my butt back when you were supposed to be kneeling, and all that kind of stuff. I wanted to chew gum. And but then I actually did go to church a lot when I was at Richmond, who did accept me. The University of Richmond did find me good enough. And but I went by myself, and I really loved it, not so much for it wasn't so much that I was thinking about Jesus and being the Son of God and the really the core tenets of Christianity, but more college is a time where you're constantly being surrounded by people, mm-hmm. And I love being surrounded by people. And this was this 1 hour a week where I was alone on that campus, and I didn't socialize with anybody at church. And I went, instead of going to dinner with everybody, I went to the 5 o'clock mass, and then I went to my retarded sorority meeting, and I really liked that. I really liked the time for introspection. So I like quiet. I like music a lot. I like reading. I've really loved reading Marilynne Robinson. That was the most spiritual I've felt in a long time. I read Gilead, and then I just finished Home, which if you haven't read them, I think they're unbelievable. And I read poetry sometimes. Like, I really like Rilke. But I don't feel resolved on it, and I don't feel, you know, I live in a place in California where there is some intellectual disdain for Christians, or anybody who believes anything, because on the face of it seems crazy. Like, there's a God, and then he had a son, and then he sent the son to the earth, and then he died, and then he came back. I mean, it's crazy, right? Just like if I were to break down, you know, the Muslim religion, we would all sound like, really? And people believe this? But I don't feel that way. I don't feel that any disdain. I feel envy, you know? And it's such a core part of my parents' life, and I think it's such a source of peace for them. And I don't know that we have that. And, you know, lately, in the last couple of weeks, I've been thinking so much about how kind of, you know, trivial decisions change your circumstances, and then your circumstances lead to these huge things. Like, for instance, I wasn't, when I was single, I never thought, I hope I marry a Catholic, or I hope I don't marry a Catholic. It was just like, I just want to fall in love. And it was taking forever, so by the time I finally met him, I wasn't too picky. And probably take our kids to church, because it would just be a habit. And the basic piece of Christianity, I think they would say, oh, I don't think about that. I mean, that's not, we just go because it's a good thing to do, it's a good community, my kids like it, they encourage us to do volunteer work and stuff like that. And I don't know why I'm holding myself to such a high standard, but I feel like I don't feel like I want to be there, unless I especially don't want to look at my 8-year-old, who's a kid that asks a lot of questions, and teach her the Our Father, and then have her come home and say, so this is how it happened. And it's like, I feel like if I'm going to do that, I should really, really, really have it in my heart. and I want to have it in my heart, but I don't feel it.
Speaking of your children, out loud. At Halloween, they asked to be the Holy Ghost.
Yeah. Yeah.
Well, that was hilarious.
Yeah. So anyway, I feel like the best I can do at this moment, so I read C.S. Lewis. I remember when I was single and my little mantra in my head, as it was dragging on a little bit, the mantra in my head was just put yourself in the line of fire. Like, just keep going out, keep meeting people, you know, keep saying yes to dinner parties and whatever, and sooner or later, you'll walk into them. And I feel like that a little bit with religion. Like, just keep putting yourself, stay open, keep reading stuff, and, you know, hopefully one day you'll feel it. Yeah. Karini, are you just so bummed back there?
I'm all ears.
Yeah.
Tuned in.
Yeah.
So I'm also a writer, but I'm curious
Bye. Thanks for coming.
About your process of getting to the place where you knew you wanted to do this and how you write and what.
Well, I always wanted to do it. I wanted to do it before I knew what it was that I wanted to do, you know. And I always wrote. I mean, I have these journals, and I always loved to write in my journal. And, you know, I would write, like, my corny poetry and stuff like that. And I always thought, I mean, I definitely always thought, like, that's the coolest thing you could do. And which is kind of an immature way to pick a job, you know. But then it just seems silly. I mean, it's such a long shot. It's such a long shot. It's like saying you want to be an actress or something. It's like, great, good luck. And I tried to write a book when I was 25. When I was a nanny, I've mentioned it a little bit in the middle place. I was a nanny for a family who lost their mom with a 7-year-old and a 5-year-old, 7-year-old and 4-year-old, and she died of a brain tumor. And then I was the first nanny on the scene after she died, and it was her. She had a first husband, and they had 3 kids. Then she had the second husband, who was a really awkward man who she met in community theater. So he was, like, great on the stage, but, like, one-on-one, you could just feel him dying inside of discomfort. But he found this woman. And I never met this woman, obviously. Mm-hmm. But, you know, I felt like I understood her because of the way people talked about her. And she was totally larger than life, you know, life of the party, had a huge sparkle. And then she picked this man, you know, who was so odd-looking and whatever, and I thought that was so romantic. And then they had kids, and then they brought her father to live with them from Fiji, and then she died. And she died in front of everyone. You know, her whole family was there, her 3 children, her 2 children, her husband, her father, and she had cancer, and she just changed, and they put her on steroids, and her hair changed color, and she gained all this weight, and she just, it was like the most visual, So anyway, I wanted to write the story of what it was like to live there. And I worked on it for a while, and I actually sent it to my old creative writing professor at Richmond, and who I really liked, and he gave me some notes on it, and then I sent it to somebody else. And then about 175 pages. You walk in a bookstore, you look at all those books. Like, all those people have the dream. And they're actually on the shelf. And they still have to get you to buy it. Mm-hmm. I mean, they already got past the first, you know, and they're going to sell 15 books a day. I mean, it's just brutal. When my dad got sick, I thought, well, I'm just going to write this for him. I'm just going to write down once and for all, this is what it has been to be your kid. And you should know. And that was enough. She gave it to somebody who gave it to somebody who got it to ICM. And the woman who got it was a girl who loved her father. And so she sold it. But my process, my biggest impediment to my writing right now is that I have monkey mind. Like, I just cannot get quiet enough in my mind to do the hard part, which isn't the writing, it's the thinking. Like, it's not, like, everybody talks about sitting at the desk for so many hours a day, which is what I do, but the hardest part is not writing, is just reading what you've written, and then literally lying like a mummy on a bed and looking at a white ceiling and thinking, like, what is that about? Is that about what I want it to be about? Or did I just start telling a story and I didn't know how to stop? Like, that story has nothing to do with where I was going. And then, you know, and then killing things is hard. Yeah. You know, because it's so much work, and then so I guess what I would say is, if anyone in here wants to write, or even like build a house, or knit a sweater, or whatever, is don't start putting a fine point on things until you know what the big pieces are. Because as soon as you start investing in like your sentences, mm-hmm. then it'll be harder to cut them, mm-hmm. and that's how you get crap. So you have to stop writing and just think, what is it that I'm saying, and why is it worth saying, and why is it worth you reading? You know? And it took me a long time to figure out that what I was really thinking about was the middle place. It wasn't like, I'm gonna write a book about what it is to be somebody's child, but also somebody's mother. It was like I thought I was writing a breast cancer memoir, and then it was like, ugh, that doesn't seem like any fun. Then I was like, I'm gonna write a book about my dad, and it seems that's kind of obnoxious. Just like, I love my dad, he's so great, for 300 pages. And then it was like, what is interesting about them? I mean, what is really underneath this is this moment in time where you still have both pieces of your life. You still have your parents, and you have your children. And you know, you just won't be in that little sliver for very long. And then once that was clear to me, then it was like, okay, now I know how to make decisions. But like when you asked me what the second book's about, it's like, I don't really know, and that's my problem. Mm-hmm. Is I don't have a way to gauge, I don't know what my agenda is. You know what I mean? I mean, agenda is the wrong word, mm-hmm. because some people are like, what's your message? I'm like, I don't have a message. I have a question. So sometimes I'm really babbling on and on, I'm gonna end now. Sometimes I think, an interesting way to think about it is, what conversation do you want to start?
Between other people.
Yeah, so if you imagine people reading this book that you've got in your mind, what is the conversation you would like them to have? Mm-hmm. And for me, I felt like I wanted to make some room for people to say, even though my dad was nice and old, and even though I had a wonderful life with him, it still feels really weird to be in the world without him. You know? And it just is an identity thing. There's an identity that changes when you are not someone's child anymore. So.
That's great.
Yeah.
Yeah, I love the part in the book where you talk about Kathy Corrigan being a young woman and telling a story in front of a bunch of boys,
mm-hmm.
and the confidence to do that.
In her Speedo. Late, I must say. Like, I mean, at our Corrigan functions and stuff, there's 24 Corrigan cousins, and I'm on the younger side, I think, that I'm one, there's like four of us that are pretty much the same age, and we're the bottom of the, so when we went to those big things where everyone was talking, and believe me, everyone is talking, no one is listening, and except the in-laws who are like, oh my God. One of my cousin that's the same age as me is Lisa D'Ambrosi. There's four of us, two boys and two girls, that are all the same age. She's got all that like confident energy. And I was there, I was so vain that they were wearing like sneakers and jeans, and I was in, I'll never forget it, in Wooded Lane. I was like, I am a princess. I am the most beautiful. This is so not cool. Like, I'm such a priss. Because there were so many cousins, there were so many weddings, and everybody got to go to, we all got invited to all the weddings. And that's when I started to get it and want it. And I got a lot of confidence at Richmond, I must say, even after joking. I didn't get into UVA, and I think that's another thing, like, that's kind of fluky, that probably changed the trajectory of my life. I think at UVA, I just would have disappeared. I think I would have struggled really hard with the work. At Richmond, you know, it was really easy. I got to be a big fish in a little pond. I totally got my sea legs. You know, I wasn't my brother's little sister. You know, my whole life I was like GT's little sister or Booker's little sister. And that was the first time that I was except for Camp Takwa, the first time that I was just some girl named Kelly. And I went in there pissed. I went in mad at myself for not having done more in high school to get into UVA. So I went in like you know, guns loaded. I was like, I'm going to join things. I'm going to run for president. I'm going to give the graduation speech. I'm going to do everything there is to do here, because if I want to apply to grad school again, I don't want to have to go through that. I don't want to have to get the no again. And then I ended up going to San Francisco State for grad school, and they literally have to accept you if you're a resident of California, so it's pretty much a sure thing. So yeah, that was a big growth period for me. Just getting, I mean, it's such a cool thing, like going to college. It just changes kids so much, you know, to be on your own. I think we're good. Does anybody have any other burning questions? Awesome. Can I have my computer? Oh, I got it back. thank you guys so much for coming. Have a great week.